Good evening, you all. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You will also hear Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and how to make all this stuff work better and how to understand it all. Occasionally we get into some of the laws of physics and subjects that are related to wireless technology. That includes television, broadcast television, digital television, video cassette recorders, slow and fast scan ham radio television, as well as satellites and moon bounce and meteor scatter and so on. There are 26 different kinds of ham radio. And quite a few of them get discussed on the technical net. Under normal circumstances, the net is primarily, the subjects that are chosen or discussed are those that are brought to the net by the people who sign in, who have questions or comments. A little bit of a difference is going to take place tonight by, somewhere around 9:30. I'd like us to discuss the situation that's going on in Hempstead, Long Island, among other places, which has recently come out with an extreme set of zoning laws with reference to cell phone base stations, which I'm convinced are quite excessive. And the reason why I think we should be discussing it is because you guys are the people who understand radio, and cell sites and cell phones are radio. The handy talkies, let me drop. The handy talkies that we began carrying 20, 30 years ago were the predecessor to what is now called a cell phone. And the public has got a strong misunderstanding of, is there a potential health risk from the use of those devices, and is there particularly a health risk for the use or the presence of cell sites within your community? Hempstead Town has set a rule of 1,500 feet minimum distance between each new cell site and places of residence, places of worship, schools, and nurseries. That essentially outlaws all locations within the town of Hempstead, which is crazy. Except for a little bit of swamp land here and there, you can't put up any new cell sites. And the fact that all the previous cell sites don't meet those rules is being ignored. And where'd the 1,500 feet number come from? Is it somebody's rabbit hat trick? It's all based on a perception of radio frequency biohazard, which is a strong misunderstanding of all the physics involved. It's going to create a lot of lawsuits and a lot of anguish among people, a lot of delay of installation of equipment for no real benefit, just based on a misunderstanding. So somewhere around 9:30, I'd like to switch over and discuss that a little bit. Because as I said, you guys are the people who understand radio. Many of us live within those towns. We have the opportunity of correcting some of the misconceptions, because radio is not that foreign to us. The so-called radio frequency radiation, RF radiation, it's a vocabulary problem. It had been called radio frequency communication, radio frequency signaling, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as misunderstood. As I said, it's a vocabulary problem. Okay. Away.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The way a person signs into the technical net is to give Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in because you're just letting us know you're listening. After 28 years, starting in September of 1982, this is 28 years later, by now we assume that there are listeners in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. It doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. Already signed in is Wesley N2XJN. I think we have a carryover from last week of WHRYY. I'm not sure Joe had a chance to get his question asked. For the other people who want to sign in with questions or comments, please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Into my Bravo, make my comment.
Okay, I got Steve, MDP. I think there was a double in there. We got Barry, Mike Bravo, and Barry, your signal was quite weak tonight, but I think we'll be able to pull it out. I think there was another person, and who was that?
KC2WGB, John, yes.
Okay, we got John. Anyone else?
KC2RFN, Alan, yes.
Very fine, Alan. And your project was very successful, as you know. And Alan also has another question. Alan, as you may know, is the person who began the proposal for the TechnicalNet being elected the Technical Service Award winner for ARRL National Award, which did take place, and Alan was the, to my knowledge, the initiator of that particular application. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters at this time.
Good evening, all. K2KEY.
Very fine. Mel? Alrighty. Wesley, as you guys know, is assembling a fairly elaborate and expensive, by my standards, laboratory in Queens. He's assembled quite a few pieces of test equipment, and he's now in the process of investigating what appears to be sources of excess energy, according to quite a few experiments that have been done in many countries, and many of these experiments are recorded on many YouTube videos. And after watching those YouTube videos, you have the opportunity to buy schematic diagrams, buy theories of operation, buy hardware, and so on, that that has these characteristics. These new super strong neodymium magnets are capable of doing things with motor generator sets that have never been done before. I personally witnessed last weekend, was the weekend before that, I think it was last weekend, the NEAT Fair held in Chinhopple, New York, in the Western Catskills. NEAT stands for Northeast Aero Technology, and there you will see a gathering of a few thousand people who fly electrically powered radio control model airplanes that are all essentially powered with neodymium magnet brushless DC motors. And those brushless DC motors, let me drop, produce output RPMs and powers that are just out of sight. We're talking about electric motors that are, let's say, 2 inches in diameter and 3 inches long, producing numbers like 5 horsepower of electrical power output. Some of them are spinning at rates of 46,000 RPM on the ducted fan models. And some of these models can fly at over 150 miles an hour. And as a radio control model, you watch somebody fly one of these so-called hobbyist things, and the airplane can go out of sight in about 6 seconds straight up. You realize, wow, what capability these things have got. Maneuvers like you wouldn't believe. So these new fancy neodymium magnet type motors and generators can do some things that were previously unheard of. That's part of the investigation that Wesley and John and others are involved in. So what's the latest in your progress report, Wesley? And what have you seen that Mother Nature is creating curiosity this week? N2XJN, K2RIW and the TechNet.
N2XJN. Good evening, everybody. Well, I was actually thinking about you and your way of proceeding with information, trying to learn something, and I found that persistence and at the same time logic will help me a lot in order for others to understand and for me as well. So thank you, Dick, for that. Well, what I have is a list of things that we might have a time to discuss, but I just am going to mention this stuff. Well, at first, in early transmitters using Spark, there were two coils. One was empty, and the other one was the coil that was getting inside of that first coil on the former. And that was, the device was called loss coupler. Then I thought, okay, we have a loss coupler that gives us inductive coupling, but we have a capacitive coupling and we have magnetic coupling. And there must be a distinction between that. And of course, how much of capacity can I create without a capacitor in physical form? And because of having lines, not one next to the other, how much of capacity I'm creating is not in how much in farads, but how much in terms of, let's say, I'm spreading that winds, and is my capacity increasing or not? Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Then the second thing that I was thinking, okay, does the spark jump in total 100% no atmosphere? That means we have a vacuum tubes. But is it that we have a vacuum tubes or we have a under vacuum tubes? So does the spark jump in vacuum? And then we had all of the variety of types of different tubes that were used during Second World War and before that. I have a Klastron, a Russian Klastron in front of me right now. I've got it yesterday. And I was thinking also, when we have a spark and we have two magnets, which magnetron was one of the first that used that, but the various number of tubes used that, then we have a differently looking spark. What then is being deflected in that spark? And then the last thing that took my attention was, before that, hammering effect. When the jump, when the spark jumps, does it have a hammering effect? That means effect. That means any kind of mechanical force instead of electrical and temperature. And the last thing that I want to discuss would be the first, if you can. But it's up to you. It depends for how much time do we have. We can spread through entire night. You have a person who is holding horizontally his hand. At the end of the hand, this person holds a piece of string, whatever. And then at the end of that string, he has a small piece of iron attached into it. From the other side, you have a pole, a post, that holds electromagnet. So when you connect the battery to that electromagnet, then of course the string is horizontally placed, and the iron is attracted by the magnetic force, electromagnetic force. Then the second scenario would be that we replace that person that is actually working, and that electromagnet that is actually working, with another post. So we have a post, string, and a piece of metal. From the other side, we have a post and a magnet. What's going to happen is there is no work being done, but at the same time, the effect, overall effect, is the same. So at first instance, there is work being done, overall work, by all components of this structure. At second, we have the same effect, but for free. And then, assuming that Kapanaza, who was able to replicate the device that is able to be for 3 seconds by 9-volt battery and then sustain the motion, taking the axis of energy, and is looked back to the beginning, and is, of course, working and powering the lamps, that then if we replace then that magnet with such supposedly device, then question is, when in each of the instances do we have
repeater timeout cancel?
I gotta control myself, I'm sorry. Okay, Dick, back to you. Enjoy Jim.
You have a number of fascinating subjects there, Wesley. I'm going to give a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of some of them. Most of the things that we call radio and similar circuits have somewhere within them usually a resonant characteristic. Let me take a very simple resonator. An ordinary, very large brass bell, like the kind that might be at a church. And because of the mechanical construction of the bell, it favors certain frequencies. If you strike the bell with a hammer, you'll hear it ring at its characteristic frequency and maybe some of those harmonics. You could, if you want to, spread some rosin around the perimeter of the bell, rub a violin bow across there, and cyclically you could excite the bell and make a very pure tone out of it. Or you could, if you want to, hit it percussively with a hammer, and the hammer really represents, at the instant of impact, a lot of individual frequencies. If you did a Fourier series mechanically of what you're doing, and the bell will favor certain of those. Now, when it comes to an electronic circuit, we usually make an electronic resonator out of an inductor and a capacitor. They could be in series, they could be in parallel, they could be part of an antenna, they could be part of an amplifier, and so on. So in the early days, let me drop. In the early days, you had a source of energy. It could be a spark gap, or it could be an oscillating tube. You had a resonator that favored certain frequencies. And then you had to try to couple the energy out of your source, whether it be the spark gap generator or the vacuum tube oscillator, or whatever. You have to try to convey that energy as losslessly as possible into an antenna or another stage of amplification. In order to convey energy from stage one to stage two, requires something called an impedance match. Obviously, if the next stage looked like a short circuit or an open circuit, very little energy would be conveyed to the next stage. You may get voltage or current, but you wouldn't get the product of the two, which is real power and therefore energy transfer. So a variometer, which also has been called a lossy coupler, and called many things, a variometer is a way of adjusting the impedance match. A variometer usually has an outer coil, an inner coil. One can be rotated with reference to the other or translated, and as such you can vary the impedance match between the primary circuit and the secondary circuit. And the variometer, or lossless coupler, has primarily magnetic coupling and some capacitive coupling, and every IF can that's inside of the IF strip of all superheterodyne, old-fashioned radios really has a degree of similarity. There was a primary coil, a secondary coil. Quite often, both of them resonated. In some cases, on some of the very early ones, you could adjust the gap between the two. Let me drop. And as such, you were adjusting the impedance match between the stages. You could create undercoupling with very sharp tuning characteristics. Optimum coupling, which gave you sort of a flat top of the band pass characteristic, or overcoupling, which gave you a mu-shaped curve. So this is one of the many sources of impedance matching devices that can be used in modern day solid state circuitry, assemblages of inductors and capacitors that are laid out as a L network, a pi network, a pi L network. There's various kinds of impedance matching. But the very early days of radio, because vacuum tubes hadn't really been invented yet, cyclic oscillator amplifier things hadn't been invented yet, the real source of energy in the beginning was a spark gap. And the nice thing about a spark gap is it has some similarity to a hammer striking a bell. The spark is a breakdown in air or some form of gaseous substance, and the way various substances behave, I'll describe that in a second, but you've got a breakdown of high voltage through the equivalent of an air gap, and therefore, by very sudden characteristics, extremely strong electrostatic coupling occurs between the source of high voltage and the resonator. So a spark gap is capable of creating, at the spark gap itself, many frequencies simultaneously, but the resonator that's beyond that point favors certain of those frequencies, and rejects the majority of the rest of those. And so the early spark gap transmitters did have something like a variometer that coupled the spark gap to the antenna, and transmission took place. It's kind of hard to believe, but some of the very earliest, very effective transmitters were spark gap transmitters, and at ridiculously high frequencies by modern standards. A man named Subramaniam Bose, who was...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Who was a very smart engineering type, physicist type human being, who was a resident of India, the country of India, became educated in London at some of the best engineering schools, went back to India and performed a number of experiments in which he used something like a spark gap transmitter, something like a point contact diode for detection. And so he was doing transmitting and receiving, and he was varying feed horns and antennas and polarization and polarimeters. He was doing experiments at 60 gigahertz in the year of approximately 1890. You Google the word Bose, B-O-S-E, and you find out about this particular man, and there's a very nice website on the IEEE web site where the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers will tell you that one of the very earliest, very effective engineers who spent a significant portion of his lifetime building these transmitters and testing the way electromagnetic waves, the way radio waves at these super high frequencies by our standards, the way they behave. You ask the average electrical engineer, what year and time do you think significant work took place at 60 gigahertz? And they'll come up with numbers like 1980. They're only wrong by almost 100 years. This guy was way ahead of his time. But now, let's talk about the spark gap itself for a second. If I took ordinary air at room temperature and room pressure, the stuff that's in the room with you right now, let me drop. And if I had a very high, if I had a voltage, a high voltage source, and I got two rounded off probes that I bring to each, close to each other, and I vary the gap until I get a spark between those two probes, I'll find out that normal air in the room has a dielectric strength, in other words, how much voltage can it withhold? The answer is roughly 30,000 volts per centimeter, or if you like the imperial units, it's around 76 kilovolts per inch. So if I've got a gap between two spherical objects of 1 centimeter, as I raise the voltage to about 30 volts, I will get a breakdown. A spark will take place. And why that spark takes place, oh boy, you'd be amazed how much physics is involved in that. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I did the experiment on a humid day versus a high, dry day, I would get very different results. Good common sense, not true. Humidity is almost not a factor. Yes, you get a lot more static electricity breakdown on a dry day, simply because the static electricity gets a chance to form in the first place. But the actual breakdown of the air is almost unrelated to humidity, almost unrelated to temperature. The majority of what creates air breakdown is air pressure. And it's opposite, again, of common sense. If I now did an experiment inside of a spark chamber in which I had air at twice normal atmospheric pressure, with the air molecules packed in twice as tight, you would assume that those air molecules are going to break down much sooner. It's the opposite. They break down later. Instead of getting 30,000 volts per centimeter at two atmospheres, I'll probably get something closer to 60,000 volts per centimeter. The higher the air pressure, the higher the dielectric strength of the air. Crazy stuff. If I go in the opposite direction, I start creating a partial vacuum in the chamber. At half air pressure, instead of getting 30,000 volts per centimeter, I'll get something like 15,000. Lower air pressure.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Lower air pressure breaks down at a much lower voltage. You can actually look at the curve of voltage versus air dielectric strength by Googling the word passion, P-A-S-C-H-E-N. Mr. Passion, somewhere around 1890 or so, when a lot of spark gap experiments were taking place, maybe earlier than that, he did a bunch of experiments with a vacuum pump, with various amounts of vacuum with high voltage probes, to find out what was the dielectric strength. And as you go to a higher and higher vacuum, the air will break down at lower and lower voltages up until you get to something like the the altitude of around 100,000 feet. Then the curve starts going in the other direction. If you had a perfect vacuum, the air doesn't break down at all. There is no air to break down. A perfect vacuum will tolerate extremely high voltages, but it's got to be a very good vacuum. Now, the physics behind why air behaves that way, or we could go into that discussion, and I probed a number of the people who I've worked with over the years who really think they understand physics. Until I read just the right articles, I wasn't getting the right answer. It's a subject that's not well covered in any of the schools that I know about. And the number of articles that discover that explain it very well are very few and far between. Now, that's if you're using ordinary air. Let me drop. There are other magic gases you can use where you're intentionally creating a voltage breakdown. Neon, argon, sulfur hexafluoride. When you have to fill a transmission line with some kind of a gas where you don't want the transmission line because you're putting very high power through it to break down, you have the choice of filling it with sulfur hexafluoride, which I believe has like 4 or 5 times the dielectric strength of ordinary air. That's the good news. But if you do break down a gap with sulfur hexafluoride, you start making poisonous gases, so it's got its side effects. Or you could just simply pressurize the high-power air-filled coaxial cable by doubling the air pressure in the cable, as long as you've got the right kind of vacuum seals, high-pressure seals on the ends of the cable. You would double approximately the voltage breakdown. So breakdown and spark gaps, that is a science in itself. Some of the early spark gap transmitters had exotic gases, had magnetic structures that controlled where the arc went and how frequently the arc restruck itself in order to maximize the transmitters. Some of those early transmitters that were used by the Telefunken Company in Sayville, Long Island, to do overseas transmission of information around the year of 1915, was an extremely high power. We're talking about numbers like 250,000 watts of spark gap transmitter set up in Sayville, Long Island, in order to give high reliability transmission over to Europe. And that was a very successful project. So that was back in the days when vacuum tube oscillators and crystal controlled transmitters essentially didn't exist. Spark gap transmitters with a very fancy variometer-like impedance matching devices between a tapped coil.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Between the tapped coil and the antenna matching, impedance matching device, a coil of wire that could be used as a variometer, which you could change the distance and the orientation between the primary coil and the secondary coil of this roughly 250,000 watt spark gap transmitter, a very, very large structure that had to be serviced periodically because those electrodes with these ridiculously high currents and voltages going through that gaseous material with a local magnetic field was creating this very high intense spark gap that did the real transmitting. So as you can tell, spark gap has a rich history, and the very early days of radio, including ham radio, were spark gap transmitters. And very slowly, crystal controlled sinusoidal oscillator type transmitters eventually took over with quite a bit of a reluctance by the old timers in the beginning, saying, why should I do this? And the main reason for that, of course, is so that you had a specific frequency, a narrow band frequency, assigned to your particular transmitter, and you didn't necessarily create interference to people using an adjacent frequency. The bad news about a spark gap transmitter is it tends to be extremely broadband. And if one spark gap transmitter is located on a ship that's sending out an SOS, and another one is located a long distance away, a ham radio operator is trying to talk to his buddy, you can see how you could easily be interfering with that vital communication. So that's a little bit about, that's a thumbnail sketch from my point of view about spark gap, early transmitters, and Mr. Tesler, by way of his Tesla coil, was also doing experiments with high voltage breakdown. And depending on the voltage that you've got, the current that you've got, the gap that there is, the method that you're generating it, whether you're doing it with a Tesla coil, whether you're doing it with a Wimhurst machine, there are lots of high voltage generating machines.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There are many high voltage generating machines. I own a Whitmer's generator that's capable of making voltages close to 200,000 volts and arcing a gap of around 3¾ inches, I guess is the best that I've done so far. To see an air breakdown of 3¾ inches of a spark that makes a nice loud sound, and the spark itself is never a straight line. It's always a zigzag. And the questions you could ask yourself is, why is every breakdown of a spark gap not a straight line? Why is it always a zigzag? Boy, you could go into the physics of that. So what's really happening at the molecular level, at the microscopic level of a spark gap and air breakdown? That in itself is a discussion that can go on for a long period of time. And how do you maximize it, and how do you understand it, and so on? How do you make proper use of it? I know I haven't gotten too far into each of your favorite subjects, but at least we've covered a little bit of the information that is not well understood, not well described in any of the books or articles. And as I said, the way that air breaks down and the way it behaves is extremely misunderstood by almost every electronic engineer that I have encountered in the United States. And I suddenly became curious about this because of a particular project I was involved in about 3 years ago, which had to understand the phenomena because it was creating grief with a commercially used system, and it was creating a significant impact to the cash flow of the people running that system. Back to you, Wesley. N2XJN, I won't dwell on you too much longer tonight, right now. We'll come back to it later. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I do understand this very, very well, although John has a question that is in this area as well. What I really would like to know is, if you can say it in a few words, if not, then we put it to later, does spark jump in 100% vacuum? That's the first. The second is, when you put magnets nearby the spark, what actually are you deflecting? Dick and Dredge.
E2OYY.
Joe recognized, if you had an absolutely perfect vacuum, you would get no spark gap, but there's a catch. And it's called the multi-pactor effect. And the astronauts of the Mercury capsule way back in the early 60s ran into the problem. They had a beautiful S-band transmitter that communicated from the space capsule down to the ground at roughly 2287 megacycles, and the signal that was being received on the ground was about 10 or 15 decibels weaker than it was supposed to be. All the instrumentation on the satellite was telling them that the transmitter was putting out the normal 10 watts of power. The signal on the ground should have been gangbusters, and it was just barely above threshold. And they eventually discovered that the materials they used on the antenna that was on the Mercury spacecraft was a material that had a poor multi-pactor effect. In other words, if a stray cosmic ray electron or whatever came along and struck the antenna such that a single electron became freed while the transmitter was turned on, that electron would be accelerated by the instantaneous electrostatic field of the 2 gigahertz transmitter, the 10-watt transmitter, and that electron would be accelerated toward the positive potential on the antenna at that instant. When the electron struck the antenna positive terminal, it released 2 electrons. The 2 electrons then on the next half cycle went over to the negative, went over to the other side of the antenna on the opposite cycle. And eventually you had a whole cloud of electrons bouncing back and forth due to secondary emission of the so-called multi-pactor effect. You had to coat the antenna with the right materials that didn't have this secondary emission. Otherwise, your transmitter would be wasting power in space. So a perfect vacuum shouldn't do that if you have the right materials involved.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So, with the exception of the multi-pactor effect, no, you do not get any breakdown of a perfect vacuum. But now the word perfect vacuum is something worth talking about. The vacuum you get when you put a spacecraft really let's say midway between the Earth and the Moon, is a level of vacuum that you almost cannot produce on Earth. The world's best vacuuming equipment you can use on Earth always leaves a few electrons or a few air molecules left over. Because the way they bounce around inside of that container, they don't find the output-exit port, if you know what I mean. A certain percentage of them don't do it. And so getting rid of the last little bit of air inside of a chamber, because you're making a so-called perfect vacuum tube, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. Okay, let's go over to Steve, the very next person who signed up. Steve, KC2MDP, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet.
On your current subject.
Dick, you can pick him up if you want. I'll wait a few.
Okay, maybe that was Joe. Joe, do you have a comment on this particular subject? Is that what we're saying? We heard only fractions of that last communication, so please repeat everything from the beginning.
I'm transmitting on the east transmitter. You should be able to hear me. Yeah, my comment was on the last subject we talked about spark gaps, is in a linear function where if you increase the distance between the electrodes, it takes twice the amount of voltage to jump that particular distance. Is that a linear function?
Is it a linear function? The answer is almost yes, but you got to be careful. Just because you and I take two electrodes that are nicely rounded and they're 1 centimeter apart, and we slowly raise the voltage on the power supply and we get to 30,000 volts, therefore the voltage gap between the two is 30,000 volts per centimeter, you will get a breakdown. If I increase the distance between the two to 2 centimeters, will it take approximately 60 kilovolts? The answer is almost yes. The reason why there's a catch is because depending on the actual shape of my electrodes, depending on the shape of the insulators and everything else in between, you may think because you doubled the distance that everywhere along that path you have halved the E field in volts per centimeter or volts per meter. You might not have. Let me give you an example of that. In the case of a round piece of coaxial cable, when you really study what's going on, you'll find out that you think you've got a nice air gap between the outer conductor and the center conductor. And therefore, if I had a 1-inch spacing between the two and I got 30,000 volts between the two, you would think you've got 30,000 volts per centimeter. Not at all. When you study what's happening, the lines of force near the center conductor of a normal, let's say, 50-ohm coaxial cable, the lines of force concentrate near the center conductor. So that near the inner surface of the outer conductor, you have a much lower volts per centimeter than you do near the center conductor. So geometry makes a difference. If by having extremely large flat electrodes with very rounded off edges, the answer to your question, is it linear? The answer is yes. But an awful lot of the actual apparatus you and I use may not have near the surfaces of the
repeater. Time out. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Near the surfaces of the electrodes, we could easily be getting a higher concentration of local E field in units of volts per centimeter. So the answer is sort of yes, but you got to be careful. Let me go over to Steve now. KC2MDP, what would you like to talk about tonight, Steve? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening to you. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Dick, this really isn't a technical question, but it does have to do with amateur radio. I am going to Canada in approximately 2 weeks, and, you know, what do I have to do to operate legally in Canada? I looked on the Internet, and I read some stuff, and to tell you the truth, it made me more confused than I am right now. So any info on that would be greatly appreciated. Back to you.
To my knowledge, there is a reciprocal agreement between the United States and Canada, and I believe, but I'm not positive, that a guy with an American ham radio license can simply drive across the border into Canada and start using his ham radio license over there with a slash Canada on the end of it. The best people I know of that could give the answer is ARRL. I'll bet you there is a subset of the ARRL website which will give you a more definitive answer. And if need be, if you simply call ARRL on the telephone and ask the question, I'm rather sure you're going to get a very good answer. Now, among the people who are listening tonight, who maybe have already studied this or have gone to Canada, what's required to do ham radio operation with an American license in Canada? If you've got information or experience on that subject, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
W-H-O-L-I-Y.
Show recognized. Anyone else?
KC2SYL. Name is Bill.
Bill recognized. Okay. Joe first. Joe, have you gone to Canada, and what did you have to do? You got it, Joe.
No, I haven't used my amateur radio license in Canada. No, I have not done that. I may be wrong, but I'm just going to put this out anyway in case I am right, because you never know. I heard many years ago that I believe the Department of Transportation is the agency you contact that has to do with amateur radio licenses.
And you didn't say it, but I guess you meant in Canada. Bill, what's your opinion on the subject? KC2, Sierra Yankee Lemur, I think it is. K2RIW. You got it, Bill. My name is Dick.
Thanks, Dick, and good evening to the net. I would recommend two approaches. First, call a Canadian consulate in New York City and ask if you could speak to someone knowledgeable there. If that doesn't get you an answer, call the Canadian embassy in Washington, D.C., and I'm sure they would be able to help you out or point you in the correct direction. This is Bill, KC2FYL.
I'm also a little bit afraid that the consulate or the embassy might have a lot of information about normal legal matters. However, ham radio operators are kind of rare. There's only one of them per 500 in the general population of the United States, and the same for Canada. Therefore, give that a try.
K2EJ.
Give that a try. But I am convinced that ARRL is more likely to have the right answer. Eric, what's your opinion on this subject? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2R. Sorry about that, N2YJC.
K2RIW in the group, KE2EJ. I travel to Canada quite regularly. And what you need to do is carry the original of your license with you. And there's also on the ARRL website a piece of paper which spells out the reciprocal agreement between us and what they call, I may get it right, CLEP or CELP country. It is a reciprocal operating agreement. And the ARRL website has all the information you need. You don't need to call the consulate. And the same thing goes for Canadian operators who operate in the United States. K2RIW, KE2EJ.
Very fine, Eric. Good sounding information. Lou, N2YGC, what's your experience along these lines, Lou?
Hey, good evening, Dick, and good evening to everybody on the net. Basically, what he just said, one of the guys I work with just drove up there. There's information on the ARRL website, and it would be a good idea to print out that one document which explains the agreement, and I believe you just got to use your call slash, I guess it would be BE.
Very fine, Lou. So it looks like the procedure is fairly simple as I see it, Steve. I think you're going to get very little difficulty. I went to Canada a lot of years ago. I remember using my American license, and I was very glad that I had a ham radio rig in the car because I had a partial breakdown, a sudden leak of the radiator of my station wagon with the whole family on board, and the local ham radio operator said, don't go to these major sites, go to this little guy on this alleyway, on this particular town, and you'll get a very good job of repairing that radiator in a with a very reasonable cost. So I got some extremely good local information in Canada. I think I was in the Toronto area at the time when through my ham radio I talked to a Canadian ham. Sounds like you're about to make a trip, Steve, and that sounds like it could be a pleasant one. KC2MVP, K2RYW in the deck net.
Thank you very much, everyone who contributed. Yes, I will definitely go to the ARRL. I went to Canada's version of the ARRL. I forget what it was called, and you know, I was reading there. I figured, well, it's Canada I'm going to. They should know more. But like I said, it confused me. You know, like Eric said, from what I understand, it if you're Canadian and you come into the U.S., everything is good. But it said something that you have to use the call sign of the province you're going to, and something about like you said, the reciprocal agreement and everything else, and it just confused me. So I will definitely look on the ARRL website. Once again, gentlemen, thank you very much for all the information.
Very fine, Steve. And when you come back from Canada, please tell us what you found, what it was like, and I bet you'll have fun talking to the Canadian amateurs. Okay, John was the next person on our list. KC2WGB, one of the people doing some of these deep experiments. How things going there in Staten Island and in Queens? Over to you, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Mel, thanks for taking my question. Things are going pretty good over here. Having a good time. I have two questions. You can postpone the second one until later on if you wish. My first question involves a vector voltmeter. Let me let it drop. I need you to clear up. I'm trying to equate the vector voltmeter as I being a dinosaur. Many years ago, we used oscilloscopes with lissajous waveforms to compare phase angles and frequencies. Is that basically what the vector voltmeter is doing in the new mathematical functions that it uses? That's my first question.
When you try to measure phase difference between an input signal and an output signal, or let's call it a reference signal and the unknown signal, assuming they're both on the exact same frequency, which they have to be, otherwise a phase shift measurement almost has no meaning. If there's a difference in frequency, you could say the phase of one versus the other is continuously advancing, and the rate of advancing is telling you the rate of frequency difference. So with an oscilloscope, you can, with careful setting of the controls, measure phase difference between two sine waves and maybe two square waves and two triangle waves. But there's a catch. By oscilloscope techniques, getting accuracy of better than 10 degrees, maybe 5 degrees, is very, very difficult. Whereas with a Hewlett-Packard vector voltmeter, can't think of the model number of the darn thing, I own one. It goes from essentially 0 to 1,000 megacycles. You dial in the approximate frequency range. It does kind of a lock-in procedure. It really is internally a superheterodyne receiver that beats the incoming signal down to 60 kilohertz. That's the real IF strip inside of the Hewlett-Packard first vector voltmeter that they built in the late 60s. And that 60 kilohertz is where it makes the measurement. Let me drop. And it makes the measurement with something that looks like a ratio detector. Or is it a Foster-Seeley discriminator? But it looks like a real electronic circuit, carefully calibrated. And that's one form. There's another form in which it does very accurate timing of zero crossings. I'm not quite sure which technique it's using. However, the vector voltmeter of Hewlett-Packard is capable of measuring down to, I think, a tenth of a degree of phase shift with reasonable accuracy. I think you can set it in the maximum resolution range of plus or minus 6 degrees across this very large Gossenval movement. And I think you can read tenths of a degree with that. So the degree of accuracy you get out of a vector voltmeter with its method of operation is considerably better than you can get from an oscilloscope. On top of that, it's got lots of gain settings where the signal that you're measuring might be, let me pick a number, 60 decibels weaker than your reference signal. In that situation, to try to set up lissajous or other kinds of patterns on an oscilloscope could be extremely difficult. And with the noise, you're going to get another confusion factor, whereas the vector voltmeter almost rejects noise up to a certain point. So, by the way, 60 decibels of difference would be a 1,000-to-1 voltage ratio. And so the vector voltmeter can easily handle that in some circumstances, where an oscilloscope does not. So an oscilloscope is a poor man's way of doing it. The vector voltmeter is closer to the Cadillac way of doing it. And a vector network analyzer, man, that's the super way of doing it as I see it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Thank you, Dick. Excellent answer. I understand now. I understand more than I did before. So we can save my second question for later if you want to get some others out of the way.
I have additional questions.
Yeah, I'm going to put a circle around your name. I'm going to come back to you. Go ahead there, Wesley.
So, in other words, if you have two signals at the same very frequency, then you do not have a phase shift. But if you have just a slight difference, then you have a phase shift?
Exactly, and I'm going to give you an example. Let's assume that my reference signal is a crystal-controlled oscillator running at 1 megacycle. And I've got a second oscillator sitting on my bench that I just constructed that I think is at 1 megacycle. And I put it on my frequency counter, and within a few decimal places of accuracy, it measured 1 megacycle. But in reality, I didn't know it. My oscillator on the bench is really running 1 hertz faster than 1 megacycle. If I measure the phase difference between the two, and if I did it with either I couldn't do it with a vector voltmeter, or maybe I could, but if I did it with an oscilloscope, I would see the two different sine waves on the screen if I decided to do it that way. I could use a dual trace oscilloscope as one method of measurement, where the reference signal is scope trace number one, and my new oscillator on the bench is scope trace number two. And because because oscillator on the bench is 1 hertz faster, 1 megacycle plus 1 hertz, slightly higher in frequency, I will see those two waveforms on the screen, one slowly crawling past the other, and because there's 1 hertz of difference, the signal of the higher frequency will crawl across the screen one whole cycle of slip per second. That's what one cycle difference in frequency really means. You could say the difference in frequency is directly measurable as the rate of change of phase between the two. If my phase shift between the two moves 360 degrees in 1 second, then that new oscillator is 1 hertz faster. If it did it in 2 seconds...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If one waveform crawled past the other waveform and it took 2 seconds to happen, then that would be 1/2 seconds, 0.5. That means the higher frequency oscillator would be half a hertz higher. So the rate of change of phase represents the difference in frequency once you figure out 1/1 time, if you know what I mean. Only if the two oscillators are on the exact same frequency will you get a steady state number when you measure the phase shift between the two. And the phase shift between the two is not only a function of what frequency they're on, but what's the line length of which you're making the measurement. I may have two oscillators that are phase locked to each other on the exact same frequency, and at the oscillator itself, there is 0 hertz of phase shift, of frequency difference, and 0 degrees of phase shift. But if I'm measuring the second oscillator through a length of cable that is electronically 10 degrees long, which is a 1/36th of a wavelength long, then the phase shift at the end of that cable will show 10 degrees of phase shift. It doesn't mean the oscillator is doing it. It means that I'm getting a distorted view of the phase shift because of the length of the cable I made the measurement through. And if I'm real smart, I can calibrate the length of cable that I'm using for my test leads and take that all back out. A vector network analyzer with a properly operating calibration procedure does that. It removes essentially all the idiosyncrasies and lengths and phase shifts of the cable through which you make the measurements. And 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2XJN. Well, Dick, today the adrenal is going to the top. everything's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, but this is my feeling. It happened that John and me, we have the same Jules Burckhardt vector volt meter. And I wonder if you have the same one, but I don't believe that you have a chance to check it out. Anyhow, thank you very much, and go to the next question.
Yeah, with all that test equipment you're assembling, you're going to be able to make all kinds of fancy measurements once you understand. And it's going to take a while. Every one of those instruments has a learning curve. They all have idiosyncrasies. They all have some great things they can do and some things they don't do so well once you learn. And the manual will only give you about 80% of the information. A lot of the other information of what your instruments can really do will be found out by talking to the old-timers that have used those instruments over the years. And they've learned things that quite often does not appear in the owner's manual, in the user's manual. Alan was the next person on the list, KC2RFN. What's newest with you, Alan? And are you going to be filling out some more applications for people? KC2RFN, K2RIW on the TechNet. Thank you.
Yeah, only the people who deserve it, Dick. You certainly should have been nominated a long time ago for the Technical Service Award, so I was very happy for you when I heard you had won it. And I know there was some difficulties and even some people trying to knock your legs out from under you, but it looks like it worked out and you got your award. And I don't know if there's going to be an official presentation or not sometime up the road, but if there is, I certainly want to be there for that. But tonight, my question has to do with something a little bit less sophisticated than what you all were just talking about, and that's satellite television. I have cable now, but I did have DirecTV on my roof, and as many other people have mentioned in the past, during heavy clouding or rainstorm, you lose your picture. It gets all pixelated, and it's like looking at a bunch of boxes that move in slow motion. So I switched over to Cablevision. And it got better, but as Cablevision increased their security by switching over to more sophisticated cable boxes, I find the problems coming back through cable. So I was wondering, you're very knowledgeable in the microwave area. Is there a way to circumvent this problem with rain clouds getting in the way by simply increasing the size of the dish or arraying several dishes together? That's my question. Back to Matt.
Don, good question, Alan. And I've got an answer for you, or at least a partial answer. By the way, the award is going to be taking place on, I think it's November 10th, in New Jersey, at a restaurant called Diageo, I think it is. And the president of ARRL will be making the award. You have the opportunity to go there if you like. So that's when the award will take place. And a number of other awards will take place at that time. Now, one of the things that's very not well known, a well-kept secret, is to when you're using direct television satellite reception at roughly 12 gigahertz, you're listening to something like a 150-watt transmitter, as I remember, to a good-sized dish. That's 22,300 miles up in the air. It's in a geostationary orbit. That means the satellite itself is directly over the equator at a particular longitude location. It's one-dimensional real estate. Let me drop. And if the satellite installer did a good job, it's a perfectly circular orbit and very little wandering during a 24-hour day takes place of that satellite. 22,300 miles, when the Earth has a radius of roughly 4,000 miles, is roughly a 6-to-1 ratio. In other words, you take the radius of the Earth, if you are making yourself a scale model, multiply that radius by approximately 6. That's how far away from the Earth that satellite is. It's really up there. And so that's a long distance for that poor signal to travel. And so it took a very high-gain dish with a lot of transmit power up in Earth, up in satellite land, in order to send you that signal with enough signal-to-noise ratio. It takes roughly 9 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio coming into your demodulator in order for it to get that signal in a quasi-snow-free manner. When a rain cloud comes along, the signal will disappear. if a branch of a tree was being waved in the wind, and if that branch of the tree waved in front of your satellite dish, again,